song. Is it?
Hello, and welcome to Whose Song Is It Anyway? I'm Dr. Hayley Bosher, and for this special season of the podcast, focusing on women in the music industry, I'll be your host. Well, Nadia, thank you so much for coming on the Whose Song Is It Anyway podcast, and welcome to Abbey Road Studios today.
Very exciting to be here. Thanks for having me.
So can you introduce yourself for our listeners and tell us a little bit about you and what you do?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Nadia Khan. I've been working in the music industry for over 20 years. I started out pretty much in music management. So I've been doing music management for most of that time. And like so many others in the industry, have my fingers in lots of pies. I'm also the founder of Women in Control. It's a non-profit organization I set up around 6 years ago to empower women in the music industry to leadership positions. And it was very much birthed from kind of my own experiences in the industry. And leading on from that as well, kind of fits into it. I'm also chair of AIM. So I was sitting on the board of AIM since 2017. And following some research that I'd done with Women in Control, looking at the representation of women in leadership roles and the boardroom, I realized there weren't many chairs. And at the time, there was only one other chair that was a woman. And that kind of encouraged me to put myself forward. And I got elected as chair of AIM in 2021 as well.
So you're doing all the things.
Yeah.
Busy woman. So thanks so much for your time, because you're doing all the things. What made you, like, what first brought you to the music industry?
I think when I was at school, I didn't have a clue what I was doing. And they used to send me to the careers library, and I was looking at these folders and nothing appealed to me. And I was studying media studies in A-level. And my teacher at the time just gave me a book about the music industry. He goes, I think you'd be great in the music industry, and gave me a book. So I read through this book, and it had all these different job roles in there. It said what a tour manager does, what an A&R does. And I read this book, and two roles stood out to me: public relations and management. And I was like, oh, I think I want to do this. So I made a plan. At the time, I wasn't living in London, and just decided that I wanted to come to London. I'm going to start in PR, do 10 years in PR, and then I'm going to go into management. I kind of made a plan of what I wanted to do and how I wanted to break into the music industry.
I feel like it's kind of like a calling for you, really. Like, you just felt like this is where you will thrive. This is where you'll fit in. Like, was it kind of the music, or it was the, you felt like you, I don't want to put words in your mouth. Do you know what I mean? Like, for you, what about it felt like home?
It was just, for me, when I read management, I was like, this is what I want to do. This just ticks all the boxes. I feel like I was really ambitious, and I just honed in on it, and I just was determined to be a manager. And I said, you know, I made a 10-year plan. I'm going to, you know, break into the industry, do PR for a bit, build some contacts up, and then I'll get into management eventually. And I gave myself a 10-year timeline to do that. What actually happened was I ended up getting into management within 2 years of me starting. So I got a work experience placement, first of all. I remember applying, coming to London and just trying to get a foot in the door in the industry. And, you know, I don't come from a really well-off background. I had to pay rent at the time, and at the time a lot of the music industry entry roles were expected to be free. They were unpaid roles, so I had to work on the weekends, work on the evenings. So I had a bookstore that I had at the weekends at a computer fair, and I did an evening job, and I ended up getting this 9-to-5 work experience placement. It was only for 2 weeks, but I went in there with the mentality that I'm not leaving. I'm going to just be the best work experience intern they've ever had ever. And they did keep me for 3-4 months. I ended up staying unpaid, and then I finally plucked up the courage to ask for a job, and I got my first role in the industry, and that was doing PR. So I started doing digital press, national broadcast press, and ended up rising quite quickly up in this company. And I was living in East London at the time as well, and it was around the time that grime music was just starting. It was just emerging, so I was actually meeting a lot of the MCs and rappers. And I really resonated with them, me coming from, you know, that kind of lower income background, and just trying to get my foot in the door in the industry and trying to make it. And I felt really resonated with these guys that were trying to build something. At the time, there wasn't a scene. There was just a belief that we can do this and we can make it independently. It was really entrepreneur spirit and hustler mentality. So I started working with a lot of the grime guys, a lot of the MCs. And that's how I met my first management client, Lethal Bizzle, who I still manage to this day. So I'm managing him now for over 18 years. And yeah, then eventually I just left and just started my own company. Just really after being in the PR company for 2.5-3 years, I really accelerated that journey, but it just felt right at the time. And I've just always followed my passions. So I was just so passionate, so ambitious. And then when I saw the opportunities, I just kicked that door open.
I love it. I mean, you're absolutely smashing it, to be honest. Like, I'm just so in awe of like everything that you're doing. And I just love this whole idea of you're like, I'm going to do it in 10 years. I did it in 2.
I just, when I look back, I think, wow, you were really ballsy. You just didn't take no for an answer. And at the time, you know, I make it sound like, oh yeah, I did it in 2. But the reality of that was, you know, when I said to Lethal Bizzle, let me be your manager, you know, I got laughed at, not by him, but he was signed to a record label. He had people around him and they said, absolutely not. She can't be the manager. And they said no to me. And they actually got another manager who was from a big company, a big male manager who had a lot of clients, who had a lot of experience behind him. And I said, right, what do I do now? This is like, I feel like this is my calling. This is my dream client. I want to work with him. So I didn't take no for an answer. I said, well, can I shadow you then? Because I'm being told I don't have management experience. Let me come to all the meetings. I came to all the meetings, took notes, and was pulling that manager up on everything and bringing new ideas to the table as well, which resulted in, you know, 3 months later, him leaving. I don't know why he left, but he left.
Bye.
Bye.
See you never.
And then I took over, but I really had to prove myself. Mm. And I think that's something that I hear a lot from other women in the mm-hmm. music industry, especially when I used to dress mini skirts. I used to wear high heels all the time. And I felt like I just got judged by how I looked right when I started out, that I just, no, we're not taking you seriously. You can't be the manager. Are you crazy? Mm. Like, people looked at me like I was just delusional to think that I could be the manager. And that, in a way, drove me to want to do it more. So yeah, I'm thankful that I didn't take no for an answer now.
Well, we are all thankful, like proud of you, doing great. I'm interested to know about that ability to not question yourself when someone laughs at you, like, you know, laughs you off, like, don't be ridiculous, you can't do that. Because there must be something in you that's like, yes, I can.
Yeah, I don't know where it comes from. I think it's my childhood. I really had a really independent childhood in a way where, you know, I was a carer for my mum. She was ill when I was growing up. And then also with my mum getting sick, there was a lot of displacement in my family. So they end up shipping me off to another country to live with some family members. So I was traveling quite a bit back and forth. And I think that gave me a different perspective. I didn't have a small town perspective or a small vision for my life. Even though we came from a low income background, I never felt that I was lower or smaller. I'd been traveling and I felt that I could do anything. So I felt really untouchable. And then when I was being treated differently, it just didn't match how I felt about myself. So I think I was brought up through my circumstances. It just helped me to build a lot of self-esteem and say, I need more for myself. And because of my troubled kind of upbringing, I also wanted more for myself. And I just had a fight in me, I think. So I just was ready for the fight. I was like, bring it on. Let's go for it. I'm going to do this. I'm going to prove myself, because I really wanted it. I really wanted, you know, this artist, and I really wanted this career, and I really wanted to be successful at it.
That really resonates with me, because I also come from a low income background, and that kind of, my childhood was about survival, and that I also have a fire in my belly, and I don't exactly know how to articulate how that translates, but there's something there about that survival nature. And also what you said about wanting more for myself, that motivated me for sure. But there's wanting, and then there's actually having, like you said, the balls to do it.
Yeah.
And I do struggle with a little bit self-esteem sometimes, and self-worth and all that stuff. But there's something in me that's like, don't tell me I can't do something, because I will do it twice over with standing on my head. Like, and I don't know where it comes from, whether it's like, when I said that, I was thinking of my nan for some reason, because she's like that, like, so, you know, life is hard. Life is gritty in a council estate. Like, that's what it was like. But it was very like, F- you, I'm doing this. We're surviving. We're going to make life better. And, you know, we're going to get through. And there's that kind of resilience there. So what you've said really kind of, I feel that has been something for me anyway, that as I, you know, you harness into a advantage.
Yeah, exactly. I think I wouldn't be in the position I am now, or wouldn't have had the career I had, if I didn't have those struggles and those challenges to overcome when I was younger. It just made me really resilient. It made me just, I think, like the word you said, survival. I had this survival instinct. So when people were saying no, it wasn't a new thing experience to me. I said, I've experienced this before. I'm going to show you. I'm going to prove it to you. And I had this knack of turning a negative experience and letting it fuel me to say, really? I'll show you. I will do that. I will do that. And actually changing and channeling that energy rather than letting it defeat me and make me push me down and make me feel like I can't do anything. It just spurred me on even more.
Yeah, I love it. So you touched on some of the things already, but what would you say is one of the challenges, or maybe the biggest challenge, that you found as a woman working in the music industry?
Yeah, so I went through this big fight to even get the job of manager. And then when I got the job, I faced so many things on a daily basis. So, you know, first of all, just people thinking that, oh, I can just, she's a young girl, I can just call her, you know, I was in my early 20s, I can just call her and just shout at her, I can bully her, I can be aggressive. So there was a lot of that happening in the early days. And I thought, right, I can't go, who can I go to? I work for myself. I'm independent. I can't go and complain to my artist. I have to deal with this myself. I have to learn how to deal with these situations. And then also, which on a daily basis, my career, just being a manager, the experience was walking into a room and just being completely ignored, being assumed to be a girlfriend, a groupie, going backstage at tours that I've put on, that I'm running, or I'm doing the production on, or I'm leading on. And just again, walking backstage and just being deemed to be just unimportant or being invisible. So many times I've walked into video shoots and I'm the commissioner because we're independent. We do a lot of releases independently. I run our independent record label. So I'm commissioning these video shoots. I walk in and somebody might even just say to me, oh, you're the stylist. Oh, are you the makeup artist? Or are you the extra? All the time this happened to me. This happened to me 2 months ago. I went to one of our video shoots and I had a bag for my artist and of some things that he wanted or some things that arrived for him. And as soon as I walked in, the reception said, oh, are you the makeup artist for the shoot? I said, no, I'm the manager. And I always get that response, that jump, that reaction, because people don't do it to be offensive. They don't mean to be. It's part of society and gender structures that we have in place that we assume these roles for a woman. So they don't expect me to be the boss. They don't expect me to be the manager. They don't expect me to be the person in charge. So I don't blame them for it, but there is a consequence to facing that every day. It chips away at me and if, you know, it chipped away at my confidence. So we spoke about me being really ballsy. And then if I fast forward 10 years of me being a manager, I was a bit of a shell of myself. I was a bit insulated. I felt quite isolated. I felt like I'd lost my confidence because I was constantly having these experiences of feeling like an invisible woman. And I was a confident person. So I was looking at myself going, why? What am I doing wrong? Is it my image? Is it the way I look? Like, what can I, how do I present myself more serious, to be taken more seriously? So that was the biggest challenge that I've had during my career, because it was really upsetting for me to, I've been on festival stages while my artist is performing and I've been thrown off and guys that work for me are staying on. And once I started to acknowledge these experiences, it just was crushing me day on. And it's just, we talk about these microaggressions and this kind of, I've likened it like compound interest kind of effect that it has. You don't realize, it's not one thing that you can pinpoint, but it's just this constant thing of these experiences every day. And it just crushed me and it crushed my spirit and I lost myself, you know, in the way.
I think what you said about chipping away is how I relate to it. And I think lots of people listening, women especially, will kind of appreciate that it's like, because it's constant, it's exhausting, it's all the time, it's every day. I remember laughing about one of the, you know, there's lots of studies and reports on this now, one about sexual harassment and bullying of women in the music industry. And I'm laughing not because it's funny at all, but where it was like these statistics about how often women are being harassed at music festivals. And I was just like, it's laughable because every single woman I know would say every day.
Yeah.
Every single f-ing day, something happens. It might be something big. It might be something small.
Yeah.
And you are telling me this number that is meaningless to me. And you want me to be like, oh, no way, 75% women have been harassed at work. Are you, oh. And you're just like, I really like what you said about the compound interest, because it builds up, it chips away. And I think for me, it's that creeping self-doubt where you said, what have I done? What do I need to change to stop this happening? And it's like, I agree, it's not people's fault if they have these roles in their mind about what women do and don't do. And I get it a lot. We were talking earlier about doctor being my name is Dr. Hayley Bosher, not Ms. or Mrs. or whatever. And constantly people, when they meet me for the first time in real life, if it's been like over email, it'll be like, oh, you're a woman. Because they assume doctor is a man.
Yeah.
And if I ever go to, say I like book a hotel with my partner and I've put it under my name and we go there, obviously doctor, oh, they talk to him, not me. So it's in society, and I get that it's not people's fault, but there is a responsibility to learn and up your game and work on yourself if you have that narrow perception, and where you assume that a woman walks in the room and she's the makeup artist, then that there's a problem.
Yes.
That you need to work on it, as in society needs to work on.
Yeah, and I think it's a reflection of our society, right? You said about these stats coming out, and although I've been part of putting out reports and data, I think the reason that I do that is because we're not believed, or we're just being gaslit all the time to be told it's not really a problem. I feel like when, you know, I was growing up, you're being told, oh, you know, women back in the day, they didn't have rights, and now they fought for your rights. You have the right to vote.
How lucky
you have
you
the
are.
Right to work. Exactly. But the reality is, when I wanted to make a change and I said, no, I'm going to speak out about these things, how do I change my situation? Let me start speaking to other women. And every woman I spoke to had the same experience as me. And I was like, this is crazy and this is wrong. Why have we all been going through this in silence? Why have I been dealing with this? This is normal. I should just accept this behavior. I should just accept this treatment. I shouldn't. And I think, like I said, it's a reflection of society nowadays that everyone does think these are the gender roles. So that definitely reflects a problem. Like you said, you know, with you getting that as well, just with your title being doctor, I can just imagine that you can face
that. Well,
it's
the same thing. And it's such a small example, you know what I mean? But I'm just kind of illustrating that it happens.
Well, it makes me mad.
Yeah. Well, it makes me mad hearing. Honestly, as you were telling the stories about being kicked off stage, I'm like infuriated. I'm like, what the fuck? It's infuriating because it's so invalidating.
Yeah.
And for you, you're like, I've been doing this for however many years. I'm not just doing it, I'm doing it well and succeeding. And then someone, you're just assuming something about me because of my gender and behaving in a way that you wouldn't behave if I was a different gender. And it's just like infuriating.
It's so infuriating. I get it all the time. I still get it. I've been on Zoom calls in the last year. And jumped on the call because my artist just said, right, you're my representative, go for this. And they're, are you the manager? Or even at an event.
They think you're like an admin person or something. Yeah.
Okay, you're the manager. How long have you been doing this? And they try and drop it in a conversational way, but it happens so much. It's not just a general question. You know when something's a general question, and I know that there's something behind it that they're trying to ascertain. Is it your company?
Like, are you actually qualified?
Yeah. Are you the manager, really? This can't be. Like, they just don't believe it. And so I find myself often saying, yeah, really long time, actually, you know, 18 years. Just sometimes just shutting them up, or sometimes I just, you know, blank it out and ignore it. But it's constant. It's on a, if I go out and about to work, events with my artists, clients, live shows, it will definitely happen.
Yeah, exactly. So you mentioned about feeling like you lost your confidence a little bit and chipped away, but you spoke about that in past tense. So do you feel that you've got that back to some degree?
Yeah, definitely. I feel like I made a decision in myself to say, I'm not happy with this, and this is not how I want to be. I looked back at myself and thought, where is that girl gone, and why did I change? And I felt really sad because I had changed the way I dressed. I stopped wearing dresses and skirts. I stopped wearing high heels. I tried to change my outfits to make myself be taken more seriously, but nothing worked. So I actually just decided, what can I do to make a change? And that's what really spurred on Women in Control. It really was from me starting to build a community of women and actually starting to change the conversation. So I feel like at the time when I was coming up, there was definitely a culture of women not supporting other women. And us as women being made to feel, well, you're different. You're a special woman. You're a different type of woman. You are cool. You don't moan. You're not difficult. You can be in this position, but you can't have other women around you. So I feel that that was definitely a culture that I experienced in the music industry. There wasn't a woman supporting other women. I definitely had no role models, nobody that I'd supported me or mentored me as I was coming through the industry. And there weren't many women in my field that I could reach out to. So I wanted to just create that sisterhood, really start to tell other women's stories and raise them up, because there was other women that I was had worked with or crossed paths with in the industry that I felt were incredible. But I kept seeing male counterparts rising up through the industry, and I didn't see them getting that recognition. I didn't see them getting promotions. I didn't get to see them, their job titles changing. So in a way, it was my small thing that I was doing just on social media, just posting certain women and just saying, do you know what? I want to raise this woman up. I think you're a woman in control. I think you're amazing because this, this, and this reason. And then I started running events and just doing my own panels. And again, changing the conversation, having a real conversation rather than saying, yeah, I'm a manager and you know I travel the world and I'm doing this TV show and we're on tour. I'm saying, actually, I'm the only woman and we've got two tour buses with 60, 70 guys and I'm the only woman on the tour. And it's actually quite isolating because how do I act to be taken seriously? I don't want to hang out with the guys. Maybe there's an age difference. Maybe their interests are different to mine. And what do I do? So I'm isolated. A lot of the time I was traveling alone. A lot of the times I was traveling alone to the venues beforehand to set up production. And again, going into this really male-dominated environment with the old school roadies who are just completely ignoring me. And that's a whole nother challenge. So I just started to have real conversations. And like I said, the revelation was everyone else had the same damn experiences. So that really spurred me on, because it was that sisterhood when I felt that everyone's gone through this. And I just feel like I still have that fighter spirit. And I said, right, we need to change this. We need to do something about this. And again, I feel like that just gave me a new lease of life, a new fight to challenge, to say this is wrong and we need to talk about this. We need to have more awareness about it, because like you said, we know when a data comes out. Yep, we live this. Yeah. Okay, you need the data to for you to believe us.
To, yeah.
But we know because we experience that. So we just need to listen to women, and we just need to actually move past that doubting stage. Or, oh, really? Oh, does that still happen? Yes, it does. If every woman is saying it, it does. So, you know, we need to move past that.
And I think just to, you know, the data is important because exactly it's validating, confirming. And I think for policymakers and even like making policy within an organization, it gives you something you can point to. And, you know, it's a shame that we need it, but it plays a vital role in that, to be, especially when it's a microaggression or it's a unconscious bias or whatever, where it's really hard to, we know it's true because we've experienced it firsthand, but to try to explain it to someone who hasn't had that experience. So I do think the data is super helpful in that sense. I wanted to ask you, because you just mentioned about the tour bus and not being taken seriously. And honestly, when I hear the story, I think for me, I would be worried about my safety. Does that ever cross your mind in those situations?
Not so much for me in those situations, because I had a group of guys around me that were always there and really protective over me in that sense. So not on in that situation, but in external situations, yes. When I, a lot of times, you know, I've had a like many other women, experiences with unwanted advances from men in the industry. And it's been really challenging to think about how to deal with that. Do I ruin this relationship, which could then impact my client's business and therefore my business? How do I deal with this? How much noise do I make about this? Do I make a big song and dance publicly? Do I speak about it privately? So there've been a few circumstances like that where I've always been really conscious of trying to build a safe space and have a safe space and have honest conversations with my team around me to so that they know that these are the experiences that I could have, and for them to kind of be allies and protect me in those situations as well. But I've still had those experiences like so many other women.
Yeah. And I think it comes back to what you were just saying about building that sisterhood, is there's so much, I feel, it doesn't stop the problem and it doesn't solve the problem, but talking about it with other people, because we carry a lot of guilt around those situations, and some people really struggle and some people have had some really horrific experiences, traumatic. And I find that it's the same thing of when you tell someone a story, this happened to me, and then they're like, oh, I have a really similar situation.
Yeah.
Oh, this happened to my friend, like blah, blah. And it makes you feel less guilty because you're like, well, if it's happening to all women, it can't possibly be my fault that it happened to me. And I think that is it's not part of solving the problem, but it's part of the healing.
No, I think you're completely right. I think even with my situations that happen, I didn't speak to anybody externally about it, dealt with it internally, and it weighed on me and it weighed on me and it weighed on me. And it's only in the recent years that I feel comfortable to say, I've experienced things too. And it just feels like a relief, and being able to tell people about it and share it, it really does make a difference. I think, you know, we talked about data. Data is really important. And I lean on data a lot to help us be taken seriously and go back to facts and say it's not an emotionally led problem. It's not me, just one woman making a fuss and being irrational. These are the hard, cold facts. There is an issue here. Let's have a conversation about that. Then another thing, like you said, is having those safe spaces to have real open conversations and not feel that I live with that for how many years? Why should we hold onto it? And like you said, feel guilty or feel that we shouldn't say because we're worried about our business. And I think by speaking out, it just, you know, would hopefully help the next generation coming through to not accept that and to expect more. And I think we need to really get to a place where in the industry, as soon as anyone hears about these stories, that we're so appalled and we're so shocked that we want to shun that person or just completely just back away from people that do that. And I liken it to drink driving. You know, drink driving didn't stop because it became illegal. It stopped because it became socially unacceptable. So we need to make it socially unacceptable that when somebody shares a story or has this experience, or somebody is found guilty of or admits to something or is caught doing something, that we as an industry make it socially unacceptable for them to continue on until they make amends or until, you know, they're punished for whatever they've done.
I think it's really important, like, to kind of say, to believe the woman in the first place. And then that also creates a safe space. If you feel like I'm going to be believed, then I'm more likely to tell what happened. And that there's repercussions so that the men are more conscious about, because sometimes it's like pure ignorance. And like you said, this society, they've been brought up in the patriarchal society that teaches you that it's okay to advance on a woman regardless of whether she's interested in you or not. They don't even consider that. They're just so confident that they definitely...
Because there's no consequences to their behaviour. So it's fine for them to carry on doing that.
Yeah. So I'm going to ask you the question. So we've talked about some of the challenges of being a woman in the music industry. And the question is, how do you think we can support and empower women in the music industry? And what do you think that the music industry needs to do to kind of meet us halfway with that and make the music industry more inclusive?
Yeah, I would like to see more women in leadership positions in the music industry. I genuinely believe that by having more women at the top, we're going to start to have better conversations, more real conversations, and start to make positive changes that are needed and necessary, such as closing the gender pay gap. And I think that all of us in the industry, we have some sort of responsibility. We all have some sort of power decision making in our hands, and we can all do our small bit. Whether you're a manager looking after artists and you have other artists on your roster, you can go and negotiate up for your other artists. Or if you're a promoter, or if you're a manager or a marketing person, whatever your role is, we all have some decision making power, and we can all use and do our little bit to make positive change in the industry.
Perfect. Thank you so much. And I also want to come back to your Women in Control thing, because I think something that we can do is to come together as women and support each other in that way too. So if someone is listening and they want to join, what do they do? How do they find you?
Yeah, so you can just go to our website, womenincontrol.com, and we have a private membership community as well, which is free, where we share jobs, opportunities, and it's just a safe space to connect with other like-minded women in the industry. And we also have a weekly newsletter, which you can sign up to, which we share lots of fun, interesting facts and points of view, lots of tips on how to survive in the music industry, maybe tips on saying no, tips on dealing with gaslighting at work, tips on speaking out. So lots of different interesting topics that we cover every week. And also you can get us on social media as well, at Women in Control everywhere.
Amazing. Thank you. So before I ask you the very last question, is there anything that you feel you want to add or say that I haven't asked you anything else?
I guess I'd like to just talk about a little bit more, expand on what I said about the gender pay gap. I think, you know, that there is a real gender pay gap in the industry. And again, looking at data, I think new data just released shows that we actually have over 60% of women entering the industry at entry level. But other data shows us that we lose women in the industry over the age of 35. And I think that the gender pay gap really feeds into that, because when you speak to women or when you look at other data, such as PRS's data that they've released themselves, I mean, they have 160,000 members. Of that membership, only 18% are female songwriters. And that number was only 13% around 3-4 years ago. And the top 10 male songwriters earned 70% more than the top 10 female songwriters. So when we start to think about, why do you think women are leaving the industry over the age of 35? I think that income, opportunity plays a huge part in it, as you know, parenthood, flexible working, a lot of caring responsibilities fall to women as well. So I think there's small things that we can do, whether, again, if you're in a hiring position, I think salary transparency would really help to make a change. So I would just like to call out to anybody to actually publish salary brackets or salary when you're putting job applications out, so that we can, I think that that's the one small step that we can take in the industry that will really help to make that gap smaller. Smaller in that gap. Yeah. Is that a word?
Smaller in the gap. I feel like that's a really good kind of suggestion, and I really hope that this is something that we can see, because with this work, there's kind of two sort of parts to it, isn't it? There's like the internal work, working on your unconscious bias and reflecting on your own behavior and things like that. And then there's like really obvious key steps that we can point to that can be like, yeah, transparency about how much you're paying each other. I mentioned this in one of the other episodes about a way that we can overcome that as women. If the company doesn't do it for you, well, talk to each other.
Yeah,
I tell my colleagues how much money I earn, and when one of them, I was like, I found out how much she earned. We have the same job, and I was earning more, and I told her.
Yeah,
and I told her, and I said to her, go and get a pay rise, like, because I negotiated my pay and she didn't. But we're on the same job. I'm not having that. So it's about supporting each other, sharing information, because the secrecy of it.
Yeah,
I don't actually know. Someone was like, you're not supposed to tell people. And I'm like,
why? Why? Yeah.
Oh, why? Because you're hiding something.
Yeah.
Exactly. So transparency, whether that's from a top-down level or forced from the bottom up, I don't care. The point is that let's not hide behind that secrecy, and that's between us as women, but also between the men as well, the allies. Like, talk to us about that. Like, it's not fair. If you're doing the same job, you're the same level, you should be being paid the same amount. So there are really obvious steps that can be taken tomorrow. You could do that tomorrow.
Exactly. It's a simple step, and it's good to give people simple solutions, because again, when we've spoken about all the problems, it just feels so vast, and it feels like, how can we do anything to make a change? But research shows that women will ask for less money. They tend to ask for less money. And then on top of that, hiring teams will tend to offer women the lower end of the bracket, because again, women are coming into a workplace, they have to prove themselves in order to get that promotion or that pay rise, whereas men are typically given a certain bracket of a salary, because they wouldn't expect anything less, they wouldn't accept anything less, and they're also given that deemed on work that they believe that they're going to do. So, I mean, research has shown this is a fact. So I think just having that salary transparency is a really small step that we can start to change the conversations in the industry. And again, like you, I've spoken to loads of women leaders in the industry and said, hey, do you know that this person's getting paid that? And we've started to build a group of us. We all get together and we share information, and yeah, and that's just so powerful.
Yeah, totally. I know, I completely agree. And there's so much research on this about, there's so many angles of why this would happen. Like the man is more likely to negotiate his pay, mm-hmm. and has a higher expectation. Plus there's the perceived, from the employer, there's the perceived mm-hmm. idea that the man is more qualified and mm-hmm. more expert or whatever. And then the woman like, oh, thank you, I'm so grateful for a job. Like, yeah. I'll just take it. So there's lots of layers to it. So yeah. it is a complicated, multifaceted issue. But mm-hmm. at the same time, there are simple solutions.
Exactly.
So final question.
Yeah.
As my mic keeps slipping lower and lower, so annoying. Final question. Who is your all-time favorite ever music maker who is female? And that could be any singer, songwriter, performer, whatever. You can take the question as broadly as you like.
Oh, it's so hard. So many. But I think I'll go for Mary J. Blige.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah, because I am an R&B girl at heart. That's what I grew up listening to and just has stayed with me all my life. And I recently found out that she was snubbed from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2021. So I heard about that last week, because I heard that, I think last week, Aretha Franklin was the first woman to be inducted. So it's kind of led me down this rabbit yeah. hole of looking at how many women are on there. And I think it's something only like 11% of women in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So I think Mary J. Blige deserves her dues. So yeah, I'm going to shout about her.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay. And then as kind of like a secondary one, maybe someone, a current, like someone you're fangirling over currently.
Yeah, I'm going to choose Little Sims, because I've been following her journey for around 8 years plus. I saw her when she first came out and she didn't quite fit in. She was kind of a little bit left. She didn't quite fit into what was going on within the black music scene at the time. And I just loved that she carved her own lane. I remember going to Toronto for Canadian Music Week and speaking to some promoters out there, and we were talking about putting a tour on, and they told me that they'd just done a tour with Little Sims across North America, and they were telling me how successful it was. And then I was coming back to the UK and I was seeing her just still on her grind, and I just really respect that she just did it independently. She carved her own lane out and was just really true to herself, and I just love to see her winning and, you know, getting her flowers now. She deserves it.
Yeah, amazing. The strong, really strong answers, which I'm sure people will relate to. Thank you so much, Nadia. It's been having you on has been amazing. You're such an inspiration, and I feel like all of the different things that you're doing are so important, and you're really making a difference. And I just feel like it's really important to acknowledge that and feel that. I'm so happy to have met you.
I know,
and
me too.
To just, you know, be having this conversation, because this is it, isn't it? Like having these conversations and just opening it up, and hopefully we'll have many more. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. And if you enjoyed this episode, please like, share and subscribe.